From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. More Americans are eating less meat, and some are giving it up completely. Reasons vary. Many people cite health issues, animal treatment concerns, or environmental impacts, specifically climate change. Today in The Exchange, as part of NHPR's By Degrees Climate Reporting Initiative, we explore the ramifications of our food choices, both for ourselves and the planet. And listeners, let's hear from you. What recommendations do you have for eating less meat or no meat? And if you've been thinking about going this route, what questions do you have about getting started? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 800-892-6477. Also, if you have a recipe to share that's helped you make changes in your diet, email it to us. We're compiling them on our show webpage, and that's nhpr.org/exchange. We're going to start off our show today with Dan Winans. He's director of the Eco-Gastronomy Dual Major Program at UNH. He's also been a chef and a culinary instructor. Welcome, Dan. Great to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, I tried to summarize it myself, but I'd like to hear from you. Why do you think more people are doing this, Dan, reducing meat consumption or eliminating it completely?
I think some people make choices about their food for many reasons. Some people, it's an ethical decision about not wanting to eat animals. For others, they might be concerned about health. Others may be concerned about environmental impacts of their food choices. So there are a lot of different reasons that people can make choices about their diet.
Well, and going meatless isn't new, of course. Back in the 60s, you know, some people went this route. Many people may know about Diet for a Small Planet or the Moosewood Cookbook. Still, Dan, you're at UNH. So what have you seen among the preferences of young people in recent years?
You know, it really varies. I don't get to see firsthand in the dining halls that much, but the students I see in class, they are really curious about sort of what the environmental impacts of their food choices are. I think that's a big thing that is driving it. One of the things that we talk about in my class is also the social implications of the food choices that you make. And, you know, upstream of the food production, who's producing this food and how are those people being treated as well?
So what are the environmental impacts of meat production? I mean, we hear a lot about greenhouse gases and grazing and so forth, but can you summarize that for us, Dan, please? What are the chief environmental concerns around eating meat?
Well, I'll speak to it in two pieces. One, sort of the conventional meat, and by that I mean the meat that you buy at most grocery stores. Most of it's not labeled as to where it specifically comes from. So the majority of the meat that we consume in the country is raised in concentrated animal feeding operations where the animals are packed in tight. They're fed a diet that may or may not be, well, typically is not what they are intended to eat. And it's a really intensive operation that requires a lot of resources, a lot of energy, and typically produces a lot of carbon dioxide emissions as well as methane gas emissions. With pasture-raised animals, it's quite a different situation. The animals live in an environment that is sort of suitable to their needs and sort of works with the ecosystem, so to speak. And there's research that shows that actually that's a way to sequester more carbon than even planting trees. If you are pasture-raised animals, all that grass that's growing is pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and putting it into the soil, and still producing good quality meat for us to eat.
Oh, that's really interesting. So let me make sure I have that right, Dan. So it's not just that cows and sheep, because lamb is also a culprit when people rank the greenhouse gases from meat. It's not just the methane that these animals emit, it's the sort of large operations under which most of this meat is produced. Is that right?
Yes, because they're growing the food for them in a way that is not particularly good for carbon sequestration, for the environment, and then trucking that to concentrate animal feeding operations. And so there's a lot of carbon, if that's what you're looking at, as far as your greenhouse gas emissions, there's a lot on that trail to get that meat to your table.
Oh, it's interesting. So rank the animals people typically eat, if you could, Dan, please. And again, talking for a moment about, you know, conventional or industrial farming, whatever you want to call it, lamb, beef, pork, chicken, venison. I've seen, you know, all sorts of charts ranking these animals in terms of greenhouse gases.
The best research I've seen is, you know, cows are the biggest culprit. Sheep, I'm not sure. I think most of the lamb that we get actually doesn't come from this country. It comes from mostly pasture raised in New Zealand, Australia. But typically it's beef, pigs, chicken. With venison, if you're getting, you know, if you're hunting, that's a whole nother story. That they're sort of just right embedded into our ecosystem. And I don't know what the carbon footprint is, but I would imagine it's very small. And when you get down to fish, they are a much lower impact as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So what about, so grazing, you seem to be saying, Dan, is okay. I mean, what about grazing land converted from forests? Is there an environmental impact there?
Some of the studies I've seen, actually, like I said, you can sequester more carbon in grasslands than you can in forests. Because the grass is more rapidly growing if you've got an old growth forest. And I'm not by any means suggesting that you cut down old growth forests, but that incremental carbon sequestered in grassland that is properly grazed. And by that, I mean that it's done with a rotational grazing that's not grazed down to dust or something like that. It's going to put more carbon, pull more carbon out of the atmosphere than a forest will.
So this is really interesting, Dan. So if everybody started eating, you know, pasture-raised meat, be it lamb, beef, pigs don't really seem to be pasture-y animals, but somebody can correct me on that. Maybe they are. If everybody did it that way, would there even be a problem environmentally from eating meat? I guess what I'm saying is it the animals themselves, or is it just the sort of industrial way that we do it?
My take on it is that it's really, it's the process that we have converted to. What we've converted to is an economically efficient way to raise meat, which is these concentrated animal feeding operations, because you can get a lot more meat for a lot less money, but the environmental impacts are high. I don't know that we have enough land to eat the quantity of meat that we're consuming currently if it was all grass-fed. That's another challenge that we have, is that typically, and your other two guests who can speak to the nutritional components of this, they can talk about, you know, the American diet is overloaded with meat, really.
So, okay. So the question is, could, if everybody did eat meat that was pasture raised, it would be a lot better for the environment. But you're saying, Dan, given that there are so many people on the planet eating so much meat, that might be hard to achieve. Is that what you're saying?
I am. I think that I don't have a study to quantify that, but you know, it takes more land to raise the same amount of meat if you're doing it pasture raised than if you're doing it in the concentrated animal feeding operations.
Okay, well, clearly this is a topic that our listeners are interested in, because even before the show started, I had about 6 emails coming in. So I'll just share a couple of those. BJ and Bob in Sullivan wrote saying, thank you for finally addressing a very important topic. Eating a plant-based diet is essential for the health of the planet, for people's own health, and for the animals. By the way, BJ and Bob did put a recipe. They sent us a recipe. We're going to put those on our webpage today. It's nhpr.org/exchange. BJ and Bob sent us a recipe for cheesy tofu scramble. So thank you to them for writing. We also got an email from Robert on Facebook who says, health and the environment are my two main reasons for reducing animal proteins in my diet. My question today, Robert says, relates to a recipe I'm starting to work on right now. Garam masala spiced ground beef from the current issue of Cook's Illustrated magazine. Robert says, I plan to use impossible meat, which I know may be controversial, in the place of ground beef. I'm wondering what your guests think about that. Robert, great question. And we're going to bring in two other guests now who can talk about some of the nutritional aspects of a plant-based diet or a less meat diet. Along with Dan Winans, we're joined now by Elise Bolster. She's a registered dietitian and the nutrition programs manager at the New Hampshire Food Bank. And Elise, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Melissa Groves Azero. She's a registered dietitian specializing in women's hormones and diet at her practice called The Hormone Dietitian. Melissa is also the author of the book, A Balanced Approach to PCOS. And Melissa, big welcome to you too. Thank you.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Well, and Melissa, to you first, from a pure nutritional standpoint, what does meat give the human body?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think, you know, there's kind of this health halo associated with a plant-based diet, but we really can't negate the nutritional benefits of meat or animal products, rather. You know, the type of protein that's in animal products is more complete, meaning it contains all of the essential amino acids. It's also more bioavailable, so your body recognizes it more easily and is able to put it to use in the body more easily. Another real benefit is the bioavailability of the iron, again, meaning that the heme iron that's found in animal products is easier for our body to use versus the type of iron in plants, which is non-heme. And another really important nutrient to consider is B12. Animal products are the only source of B12, which is a really important nutrient. You don't want to be deficient in B12 because some of the effects of a B12 deficiency are actually irreversible.
That's interesting. And so bioavailable, right, Melissa, has to do with your body can use it really easily. It doesn't need to work to get a hold of the protein and all the other nutrients that you talked about.
Exactly.
Yeah. What would you say, Elise? That's really interesting. You know, we will talk later about some of the drawbacks of eating meat, but what are some of the benefits?
Yeah, I'm glad Melissa brought up all of those great benefits that meat has, because when I typically talk about animal proteins or proteins in general with any participant or client that I work with, you know, I don't necessarily talk about eliminating anything from your diet. I think there's a lot of nutrients, just as Melissa said, that are really important that come from animal proteins, but it's more meat. And maybe, you know, eating more of the other good things and less of it, but not eliminating it, because there are so many benefits that come with it that we don't necessarily need to restrict. We can maybe just think about how we can eat less.
And Elise, in terms of some of those benefits that you and Melissa are talking about, are they the same with, you know, pork or chicken? You know, some of those nutrients that Melissa mentioned?
Yep. So Melissa talked about animal proteins being more complete and having those 9 essential amino acids that we need that are bioavailable in our body. So pork, lamb, beef, any animal proteins, they have those complete proteins. So when we eat more plant-based, we tend to have to find ways to complete those proteins by pairing beans with grains and by eating different things that have different amino acids to make that complete protein. So when you eat animal proteins or complete proteins, you're getting everything that you need to really make that work in your body. Whereas when you're eating plant-based, you have to know where those amino acids are found and make sure that you eat them together so you're getting those complete proteins.
Okay, so here's a question I bet a lot of listeners have, and this is what I read earlier from Robert, who is going to use impossible meat with his recipe for garam masala spiced ground beef. And he's wondering what you guys think about that. So, Melissa, I'm sure you're getting these questions from, you know, your clients. What about all these new meat substitutes that we see out there, including Impossible Meat? Are they as good? You know, what do they bring to the table?
I don't even know where to start with this one. I was actually very fortunate to take Dan's class at UNH. So, you know, I'm always thinking about sustainability and how far a food travels to get to us. So I do get asked this question all the time. And I think that there's, you know, again, this sort of health halo that because these products are plant-based, they must be good for you. But, you know, that's really not the case. You know, these, the Impossible and Beyond and all of those sort of Morningstar things are not necessarily better for you or the environment than eating meat is. If you consider, you know, these are very, very processed products made from things like soy protein concentrate, sunflower oil, binders, vitamins and minerals added. Another thing that hasn't really come up yet is the fact that most soy grown in the United States is genetically modified, unless the product specifically states that it's organically grown. And it's not so much the genetic modification itself that's worrisome. It's the fact that the crops are engineered to withstand more pesticides. So these types of products have a higher glyphosate load for your body, which is introducing more pesticides to your body. And that definitely has been linked to cancer. You know, and I know Elise can speak more to the price point of these sort of products versus meat, but, you know, pound for pound, it ends up being something like $26.99 a pound for Impossible Meat versus $5.99 a pound for organic grass-fed beef. You know, there's definitely some smaller brands out there that are making meat replacements with whole foods ingredients. But you do want to keep in mind that these aren't a nutritional equivalent to meat. They're much, much lower in protein. So, you know, I do recommend using more whole soy and legumes and plant-based sources of protein as opposed to using these replacements in high quantity. And for the listener's question, I would recommend using like a ground tempeh in place of the ground beef in that recipe.
Yeah, so it sounds like Robert could use ground tempeh because that has that sort of tighter consistency that you would need if you're gonna replace ground beef. Or it sounds like you're saying, Melissa, just use some, if he isn't a vegetarian, just use some good grass-fed beef. Wow. Okay. So I want to ask our other two guests about this as well, because I know people are interested in these products. Dan, the environmental impact of some of the new products that we're seeing out there, Impossible Meat and Impossible Burger and all that stuff.
Well, I think that the replacements, I actually brought some of them into one of my classes to do a tasting so that students could experience it. We tasted them and it tasted a lot like, to me, like a burger from one of a fast food restaurant, you know, that not super flavorful. As far as, I'm sorry, I got off track.
Of the environmental impact of some of these products.
So I did a little poking around about it, and they tout like the lower, use of water and carbon output and things like that. And so I think that probably pound for pound are pretty accurate that they don't have the same environmental impact as your conventional grocery store ground beef. But one thing that they are not paying attention to is the biodiversity aspect of the equation that is a really essential component to our food system that they are dependent, as Melissa said, dependent upon these high quantities of either, you know, soybeans, expeller pressed oils, that they're continuing sort of a big problem that pervades our food system of working with big monocultures where they're growing only thousands of acres of one thing, that really fights against nature. Nature doesn't really like monocultures, and it throws the balance off, and has wide-ranging environmental implications to be producing things in that way. So environmentally, I would go with Melissa's suggestion of grass-fed beef or a sustainably produced tempeh, because that's probably the best option.
Yeah, and that's sort of one food that you can pronounce instead of, you know, 16 different odd foods mashed together with who knows what. Robin, I'm glad you wrote. This is a big issue. Dan on Facebook also wrote, regarding less meat for a healthier planet, I examine the facts to the best of my ability and can only conclude local is the best option for health and planet. Dan says, out of season fruit, monoculture, soy, wheat, etc., all have pitfalls. So Dan, thank you for writing. And it kind of sounds like what our guest Dan Wyness said earlier. Liz in Holderness wrote, we found that working to limit our meat purchases to local, ethically, sustainably, and humanely raised and processed meat and poultry led to an overall reduction in the amount of meat we were consuming because the good local stuff is significantly more expensive. Liz says, it's really nice to know where our meat is coming from, who's raising it and processing it. Not everybody has the kind of access we do, of course, and the expense is often a significant barrier for many folks. Liz says, I find Michael Pollan's advice a helpful touchstone. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Liz, thank you for writing. And Elise, I did want to ask you about this. You know, Dan laid out the reasons early in the show about why sort of grass-fed, locally raised is a lot better for the environment. But Liz is right, it's expensive. So at the New Hampshire Food Bank, where obviously you're trying to stretch every dollar, how do you work around that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I love hearing all the conversations around it. Because at the New Hampshire Food Bank, a lot of the curriculum that we teach is based on MyPlate. It's the USDA dietary guidelines. So if you're familiar with MyPlate, protein takes up about one quarter of the plate. And so I think, as Dan was kind of explaining in the introduction, you know, as Americans, we eat far more animal proteins than we really need and that our body can really absorb. So it might be just changing the conversation about how much do we need and what does that look like? And you guys think about your plates for, you know, breakfast, lunch, or dinner, how much of your plate consists of protein or animal proteins, and how can you adapt your plate to maybe consume more vegetables or highlight your plate with vegetables first and then have the meat or the protein come secondary. And I think if we change our mindset around what our plate looks like, we might in turn, eat less meat, and it might come naturally instead of feeling pressure to eat less of it. Or, I mean, I guess it depends on what you care about and why you're doing it. And I think eating locally is great. And I too think it's something that I'd like to strive for, but it is really expensive. So I really highlight my plate with colorful fruits and vegetables first and be excited about them, make them really tasty. And then I don't eliminate meat, but I definitely try to have smaller portions of it that my body can digest and absorb and still meet my nutrient needs without eliminating it.
Let's take a call. And this is Noelle in Alton Bay. Hi, Noelle, you're on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and just talk about, I just felt like the vegetarian side wasn't being represented properly. They were talking about like the health benefits of eating meat, and medically I'm not sure that anybody relayed that, like what the actual benefit is of eating meat.
Well, and I'm glad you called, Noelle, because I was going to go with my next set of questions to saying, okay, we talked about some of the health benefits of eating meat. Let's talk about the health drawbacks. So I think I'll turn to you first, Melissa, on that.
Yeah, I'll say that, you know, what the evidence really bears out in terms of meat and including animal proteins in the diet is that the drawbacks are primarily seen with processed red meats. So meaning, you know, cured, smoked, deli meats, sausages, the way we cook meat is what impacts our health. So when we cook it on very high heat or grill it and it gets charred, those are the compounds that are carcinogenic. So really, you know, there's definitely some benefits seen with vegetarian diets, but they're often compounded by the fact that, you know, these people were living healthy lifestyles in other ways as opposed to just their diets. For example, a lot of the studies on the benefits of a vegetarian diet have been done in Seventh-day Adventists who don't drink alcohol, they don't smoke, they have a lot more going on than just not eating meat. So what the research really bears out is that we don't have to, you know, what Elise said, we don't have to eliminate it entirely to get the benefits from adding more plants.
Well, and Wanda emails, after watching the documentary, What the Health? My husband and I switched to a plant-based diet over the summer for the health benefits. He's lost 25 pounds. Wow. His blood pressure and cholesterol are way down and he no longer snores. Yay for me on the snoring, Wanda says. Wanda also says, I find quite a few recipes on the Forks Over Knives website. She says, I also really love the Engine 2 cookbook by Rip and Jane Esselton. So that's from Wanda. Thank you, Wanda, for the email. Noelle, thank you for the call. After a short break, we'll talk a lot more about this, how people are eating less meat or no meat. We will also ask about dairy and all those plant-based alternatives to dairy that are there these days. And we'll keep hearing from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call, like Noelle did, 800-892-6477.
Donating your old car or truck to NHPR is an easy way to support the news you trust, especially in times like these. We'll arrange to have it picked up safely, running or not, and invest the funds right back into the NHPR programs you love, like Morning Edition, The Exchange, and The Folk Show. Donate that unwanted vehicle today and keep your community informed and connected at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. What we eat and its impact on our health, both our own and the planet's. We're looking at why more Americans are eating less meat, and later on we'll share some cooking tips if you're thinking of going this route. Join our conversation right now. It's exchange@nhpr.org if you want to email us. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Dan Winans. He's director of the Eco-Gastronomy Dual Degree Program at UNH. Also, Elise Bolster, Nutrition Programs Manager at the New Hampshire Food Bank. And Melissa Groves Azero. She's a registered dietitian. Her practice is called the Hormone Dietitian. And Melissa, what about dairy? Many people have no problem going vegetarian, but they don't want to give up their cheese. So what are the health benefits and drawbacks, as you see it, Melissa, of dairy?
Yeah, I'm actually allergic to casein. Like, I will break out in hives. So I don't get the vegetarian cheese. I keep trying and it doesn't work. So I'm very jealous of people who do get to include cheese in their diet because it's delicious and it adds that, you know, satisfaction factor that I think is so important, especially if you're eating a plant-based meal. Dairy obviously is very full of protein. It is has nutrients that, you know, again, are very bioavailable. The minerals like magnesium and calcium, and it's also a source of vitamin D, which most people tend to be short on where we live. As far as benefits of dairy, it's a little bit all over the map. It really kind of depends on who you're looking at. For example, in the niche I work in, which is fertility and pregnancy, full fat dairy has actually been associated with better pregnancy and fertility outcomes. Whereas for men, it seems like the low fat dairy tends to be better for them.
Oh, that's interesting. Elise, how do you work with dairy and talk to people about dairy?
Yeah, so when you're thinking about dairy, the nutrient that you want to really look at is the saturated fat component, which tends to be in any animal product. And when you were talking about meat, beef maybe versus chicken, you know that chicken's a little bit leaner. It doesn't have as much saturated fat, whereas sometimes you can see that marbling in the meat. And it's the same that goes for dairy. So looking at the saturated fat content, and just to describe saturated fat a little bit more, because fat is a macronutrient and it's really important for our health. But the kind of fat that we eat is also really important. So saturated fat is fat that's solid at room temperature. So if you think about butter, it's solid at room temperature. And if you think about olive oil, it's liquid at room temperature. And olive oil is a mono and polyunsaturated fat, whereas the butter is a saturated fat, and it's the animal-based fat. So I'd say when we look at dairy, you know, if you can't tolerate it, there's of course alternatives, soy and almond and rice and oat. There's all kinds of alternatives to dairy if you're intolerant to it. Oftentimes you're going to find those vitamins that you usually get in dairy, such as calcium and vitamin D. Those are fortified in those alternatives. So you're not necessarily getting that, they're not found naturally, they're fortified in there. You still could be getting them, maybe they're not as bioavailable. But looking at the saturated fat content and looking at the nutrition facts label and trying to get 20% or less. So, you know, maybe you're drinking whole milk now, maybe you can, you know, bring that down to 2% or 1% over time, and make small changes to your diet to eat less of that saturated fat component, which tends to not be as healthy for us.
And Dan, from an environmental standpoint, how much is dairy, traditional dairy, I'm not talking about soy milk, when it comes to greenhouse gases and other environmental impacts?
Well, again, I think you've got this dichotomy of, you know, pasture-raised animals versus animals that almost never leave the barn. If you go and get your regular conventional milk at the supermarket, there's going to be a bigger impact. It's not as great an impact as beef, you know, as far as, you know, the environmental impacts. But again, your better choice is getting something that has been pasture raised so that it is helping the environment rather than hurting it.
And what about, Dan, the many dairy alternatives that Elise mentioned? Do some of them have an environmental impact? For example, I remember there was a bad drought in California a couple of years ago, and people were talking about the amount of water that almond trees took to grow.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, almond trees and almond production may be coming to a screeching halt because California is under tremendous pressures for their water, and almonds are a very water intensive crop. I'm not aware of other crops though. I mean, with soy milk creates some of the same challenges of if it's not an organic soy milk or a non-GMO soy milk, it's going to have those same pesticides sprayed on it, grown in vast monocultures, and degrading the land that we are going to need to feed ourselves in the future. So I wouldn't say, oh, that's a fantastic environmental choice.
Yeah, too bad, because I know nutritionists often advise you to eat almonds because they do have health benefits. Going back to our listeners, Patty in Wolfboro writes, I am a registered dietitian in private practice, and I put a strong emphasis on whole food, plant-based choices. My concern with animal proteins, besides environmental and ethical implications, are they are a primary source of saturated fat, growth hormones, and antibiotics. These byproducts are stored in our body and affect our risk of most of the chronic conditions Americans suffer. Patty, thank you for writing. And Melissa, this sounds up your alley. I know you look at this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The growth hormones, you know, are what are naturally present in the meat. And, you know, I'm sorry, I can't remember which type of meat specifically the growth hormones are allowed in and which they're not. Dan might know. But if they're only allowed to be used in certain products. And when you look at the amount of growth hormone present in a piece of meat, it's such a tiny, I mean, millionths of a fraction of what our own body produces in terms of hormones. So hormones are not really a concern for me when it comes to meat. I think, you know, with dairy, it's a little bit of a different story because our estrogen, our female hormone, is stored in fat. So when you take the fat out of milk in the form of skim milk, then all that's left is the androgens, which can throw off your hormone imbalance. As far as antibiotics, that's a myth. You know, it's a myth in dairy and it's a myth in meat. They test, you know, only sick animals receive antibiotics if they are raised in a humane way. They test all meat to make sure and dairy before it even hits the market to ensure that you're not getting any of that. And as for the saturated fat, you know, the more recent research has been showing that it wasn't ever the saturated fat that was the problem in the first place. You know, we removed butter and saturated fat from the American diet essentially in the 80s, and heart disease went up, obesity went up, diabetes went up, and then it was kind of like, oops, it was actually the partially hydrogenated vegetable oils that
I remember all that. It. Yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, Elise has talked about, you know, you want to make sure that your whole diet is, your entire fat intake is not made up of saturated fat, but, you know, a little butter on your toast is not going to kill you.
Well, here's an email from Nancy and Keen, who says, another consideration for those who choose local meat for reasons of more ethical animal treatment might be to do some research on where these animals are slaughtered and the company's histories of humane violations. Nancy says, I'm told that farmers have few choices when it comes to processing their animals. Nancy, thank you for writing. Josh in Portsmouth also writes, last January, after years of advocating climate policies, I put my money where my mouth is and stopped cooking meat. I still purchase free-range eggs from the farmer's market and treat myself to well-sourced meats when I eat out. Advocating meat as a delicacy might be more persuasive than telling people they must go whole hog to save the planet. Josh, thank you for writing. And Dan, what do you think about that last line? Instead of telling people stop eating all animal products right now, consider them more a treat.
Yeah, I would go, I wouldn't even go as quite as extreme as that in my personal view on it. But yeah, looking at, you know, as more of a small part of the meal rather than building a plate with a, you know, a 12-ounce steak in the middle of it and then a little bit of vegetables around the edge to make it balance. Starting with, you know, one of my favorites is stir fries. I've got 9 people in my house and I can make a giant stir fry and feed all of them, but you can make meat go a lot further with that, with a lot of vegetables in there. And one of the things that came up earlier was about the cost of local meats or pasture-raised meats. And if you get a little creative as far as the cuts that you get, you can bring the price back more in line with what you see with conventionally raised meats. You can't get a porterhouse steak for cheap, but you can get chuck roast or skirt steak or flank steak or something like that. Takes a little more finesse in the kitchen to make that come out as well as just easily throwing a steak on the grill, but with a little bit of practice and effort, you can do that.
Yeah, and let's talk about specific groups of people and how a shift to a more plant-based diet, whether, as Josh says, it's all the way or just part of the way, how that affects specific groups and their nutritional needs. And Elise, I'm interested in kids because sometimes you hear parents say, oh, you know, my teenage son or daughter wants to go vegetarian. I'm concerned that they're growing and they might not get what they need. So how do you think about moving toward a more plant-based diet for people in sort of specific nutritional categories?
Yeah, so I think that it depends on the person, but in general, I mean, the participants and the clients that I see, vegetables don't tend to be the emphasis. So I think starting with just making vegetables more fun, exposing and eating vegetables in different ways can make it so that you're getting all the nutrients you need without having to, like I've said before, you know, eliminate that food group completely. And you know, the Cooking Matters curriculum that we teach, we emphasize how you can shred or dice or puree vegetables and different things, and you can really stretch your food dollar that way too. One of my favorite Cooking Matters recipes is the turkey tacos, and you know, we start with the ground turkey, but we add, you know, a whole shredded sweet potato, a whole shredded carrot, a whole shredded zucchini. We add pinto beans to it. We add a can of diced tomatoes. So there's so many vegetables in there that you're stretching that ground turkey so much farther, and you're not eliminating those nutrients that you're getting from the turkey or the protein, but you're also getting so much more with all those colorful vegetables, the fiber, the different antioxidants and the phytochemicals that come from those different colors of vegetables. So I think that, I mean, you wanna hear your children's plea and becoming more vegetarian, but I'd say focus on just including more of those other food groups, looking at your My Plate and having fun with food, cooking with it more, identifying what you like, what you don't like, and how to just maybe eat more of the things that you want to without.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so I like what you're saying, Elise. And by the way, those vegetables that you're stretching with, you know, in general are not expensive. Carrots are not expensive, sweet potatoes and so forth. So it sounds like you're saying, Elise, don't focus on for yourself or your kids, here's what we're not going to do. It's more, let's focus on what we're going to do. We're going to have some fun with these foods.
Exactly. Yep. That's my mindset. You know, involve your kids in the process, let them be involved in the menu, go to the grocery store with them, let them pick out a new fruit or vegetable that they've never seen before. You know, cook it in a couple different ways, talk about what it is that they like or didn't like about it, you know, involve them in the process of cooking it, you know, get in the kitchen, know where your food comes from, and have fun with it. It really should be fun because it's something that we need, you know, to nourish ourselves every day. It shouldn't be so complicated, even though when it comes to nutrition, it is. But if we stick to the basics and, you know, think about whole foods in a certain way, we don't have to think about food as being so complicated.
Well, and so perfect segue to what we're going to talk about after a short break. We've talked a lot about why and how people are choosing to eat less meat or none at all, but we're going to turn to now how people are doing it, some of the fun ways that you talked about, Elise, and I'll ask Dan and Melissa about that too. And we will share some recipes. We've got some on our website already. You can submit yours. You can email them to us at exchange@nhpr.org. And you can join us. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're examining how and why more Americans are deciding to eat less meat or none at all. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call 800-892-6477. We have three guests. Dan Winans is director of the Eco-Gastronomy Dual Degree Program at UNH. Elise Bolster is nutrition programs manager at the New Hampshire Food Bank. And Melissa Groves Azero is a registered dietitian with her own practice called The Hormone Dietitian. And listeners, if you have a recipe to share that's helped you make changes in your diet, moving more towards plants, email it to us at exchange@nhpr.org. Our producer, Jessica Hunt, will be compiling the recipes on our show webpage. We have a bunch there already, some from listeners, one from me, and some from NHPR staff if you need some inspiration. I think Peter Biello has one up there as well. Our webpage is nhpr.org/exchange. To check out those recipes, nhpr.org/exchange. So Dan, Elise, Melissa, let's get into the fun part. And Elise was starting to go there before the break. Just ideas for cooking with less or no meat. And Dan, to you first, what are some ingredients that you find yourself going to again and again that provide that centerpiece or that protein that many people associate with meat? So go ahead, Dan.
I have to admit that I don't focus on vegetarian cooking. Like I said, though, I do focus on including lots of vegetables, and I don't have a one favorite to go to. I really
like a go-to tofu guy or a go-to black bean guy.
No, not at all. I'm a go-to lots of different things. and I've got lots of kids and I want them to keep trying lots of different things because I want them to continue to grow their food palates so that they will be adventurous eaters throughout their lives.
So sounds like from that description you gave us earlier, Dan, you know, you just make these giant stir fries and sure you've got some meat in there, but you're really stretching it out with, you know, the rice and the vegetables and so forth. That kind of sounds like your MO, not no meat, but focusing on using a lot less and enhancing it with a bunch of other stuff.
Absolutely.
How about you, Melissa? Do you have sort of a go-to when you want to go meatless?
Yeah, so kind of the same as Dan. You know, I don't really make it a focus when it comes to dinner. We're so lucky to be on the New Hampshire seacoast. We eat a lot of local fish, for example. I do try to do, you know, one meatless meal a week for dinner. And, you know, my kind of go-to when it comes to legumes is red lentils. Those are pretty much the only bean I will cook from scratch because the other, you know, they're the only one that doesn't take like 3 hours to cook. you know, otherwise I'll do similar to what Dan does and make a giant stir fry and add some tofu or tempeh. You know, but that's just dinner. I think, you know, when you're thinking about your day as a whole and your week as a whole, how many of those meals you can add plants to. You know, most of my breakfasts are plant-based or at least ovo-vegetarian, which is, you know, vegetarian plus eggs. I do a lot of like egg and veggie scrambles or egg tacos. I'll do smoothies that have fruits and vegetables and a protein powder in there. You know, lunches, we'll do like lentil soup or chili, or I'll do a big salad, but I usually add tuna and chickpeas to that.
Well, and, you know, I was reading something yesterday, actually, in preparation for the show, where this one writer said, kind of relating to what Josh in Portsmouth wrote earlier, maybe you don't want to go all the way, but just don't have meat for breakfast and dinner. And then, I mean, breakfast and lunch. And then for dinner, you can kind of, you know, stretch it out the way that Dan was talking about earlier. How about you, Elise? Do you have any sort of...
I think you broke up a little on my end. Or I think you're asking what my go-to is. And I think that beans don't get enough credit. I mean, like I've said, I'm definitely like the other two. I'm not a vegetarian, but I do try to eat more plant-based or highlight or emphasize those veggies in my meals. Or even, you know, whole grains. Those also don't get a lot of credit. But there's so many different kinds of beans and they're so inexpensive. You know, you can grab a can of beans for 69 cents to a dollar, and they all have different textures, different colors. They go with different foods. You can add them to soups. You can add them to stir fries. You can add them to scrambled eggs. So I think having them on hand, just having a couple different varieties of beans on hand and experimenting with them, and, you know, setting a goal. You know, if you're not familiar with eating beans, maybe the goal is to get through the can of beans for the week, and you toss them on a salad, or you throw some in a scrambled egg, or you make sure to put them in the stir fry or the soup. And those small behavior changes actually kind of encourage you to find ways to get them more, and then they become part of your everyday habits and what you enjoy and what you like to eat.
Yeah, and speaking of beans, so I think I'm with you, Melissa. I tend to just buy the canned beans, but Wanda wrote a very important tool for the vegan kitchen is a pressure cooker for beans. You can cook them easily and quickly. On the stovetop, Wanda says, I have a tendency to boil them over or forget about them and they boil dry. Wanda says, I cook whole bags of dried beans and chickpeas. I let them dry and cool on a sheet pan and then put them in the freezer in a Ziploc bag where they are ready for any recipe at a moment's notice. Wanda, thank you for that tip. You know, all of you, we talked earlier about kids and Elise talked about, you know, the specific nutritional concerns that growing kids have and how to keep them on that growth path, even if they want to eliminate meat from their diet. What about athletes, Dan? Do athletes have sort of specific requirements? And how do athletes sort of move towards a more plant-based diet?
I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that question because I'm not
Yeah, let's throw it to
the
Melissa then. Sure.
Yeah, I can take that. Well, the great news is for athletes, what matters the most is quality carbs and quantity of carbs, which are ample on a plant-based diet. You know, you want to make sure that they're meeting nutrient needs, especially if they're teen athletes who are growing and active, because you know some of their needs are much higher. But you know, general sports nutrition is to eat carbs before a workout and then follow that up with a balance of protein and carbs after the workout.
That's interesting. So you talked early on, Melissa, about sort of, oh, I can't remember exactly how you put it, a health halo around meat. Is that especially the case, Melissa, with athletes?
I mean, I'm thinking back to my time in the UNH dining hall when all of the student athletes would basically get the hard-boiled eggs and discard the yolks and just eat like 12 egg whites for breakfast. I think, you know, protein's definitely emphasized. It really kind of depends on the sport and what the goals are. You know, the football team would totally, you know, blast through a dozen eggs in about a half a minute. For sure.
You know, Dan, we haven't talked yet about eggs and sort of their impact environmentally and in terms of our whole food system. How do you view eggs, Dan? How do you talk about them in your class at UNH in terms of their impact on the environment?
Well, I don't know that we specifically covered the environmental impact. What I would say about eggs, though, is that the nutritional quality of the egg is directly linked to the way the egg is raised.
Oh,
That
really?
the eggs that you get in the supermarket, again, the conventional eggs, you get the store brand eggs that are 99 cents a dozen or something, you're getting what you paid for. You're not getting as many nutrients, and the animal welfare is rather poor for those animals. I know, I mean, living in New Hampshire, there's a lot of places where people can just have a couple of chickens in their backyard. Chickens are amazing creatures as far as if you've got food scraps after your meal, preparing your meal, you put the food scraps in the pen with the chickens and they turn it back into beautiful protein to put on your plate the next day. And the nutrient quality of those eggs is going to be superior to the ones that you get, just the generic ones in the store.
Oh, that's interesting. We did a whole show, Dan, just FYI, on this whole backyard chicken trend. And you're right, the nutritional quality is great. But we also heard from our guests that backyard chickens, if you're going to do it right and not have your chickens become snacks for local bears, you have to spend a lot of money, you know, setting up the cage the right way and so forth. So that was kind of, just wanted to throw that out there. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Do you consider, Dan, somebody who eats eggs a vegetarian?
I do. I mean, vegetarian is really a broad term. I mean, you know, there's a
Right.
whole host of people that fit under that umbrella. Some are, you know, ovo-lacto, so they choose to eat milk and dairy. You know, some are, you know, I've met people that call themselves vegetarians, but they are, you know, locatarians or something, that they'll eat local animal products on occasion. So it's a personal, I mean, I don't I'm not big on labeling people, and people have their own sort of philosophy on eating. I think it's really important that people be educated about their food, that they are be curious and learn about their food, and then make choices that fit with their health and their ethics and their view of the planet.
Well, lots of people still writing in, and we won't have time to go to all the emails, but I did want to share one from Jeronima, who says, 10 years ago, I read the China study and decided to become a vegetarian for health issues. Jeronima says, the trick for me has been finding and creating delicious recipes. The organization that has greatly inspired and helped me on my path is the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. So, Jeronima, thank you for writing. And I also want to encourage listeners to go to our webpage for today's show. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And we've put some recipes from our guests, from listeners, and from some of our staff there if you are interested in sort of getting started on this. All of you, we have run out of time, but Dan Winans, it was really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That's Dan Winans. He's director of the Eco Gastronomy Dual Degree Program at UNH. He's also been a chef and a culinary instructor. And Elise Bolster, it was good to have you too. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura.
That's Elise Bolster. She's a registered dietitian and the nutrition programs manager at the New Hampshire Food Bank. And Melissa, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
That's Melissa Groves Azzero. She's a registered dietitian specializing in women's hormones. She's the author of the book, A Balanced Approach to PCOS. Today's show was produced by news host and exchange producer, Jessica Hunt.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.